this episode of GeoTalk, we discover what exactly is happening with OpenStreetMap, we prepare for our trip into the South Pacific, and we look at how you can complete the Yasma Challenge. All this and more on GeoTalk. Welcome to GeoTalk episode 90 for August 2012. I'm your host, Darren, from the Spin Doctors. Welcome to the podcast. If you haven't checked out our website, don't forget all our show notes and any other bits and pieces of information that we add appear on our website at geotalkpodcast.com, geotalkpodcast.com. You can also discover the email link if you want to drop us an email, which is geotalkpodcast@gmail.com, or you can give us a call like some of our listeners have in this episode on 02 800 50 436. So if you're calling from Australia, that's 02 800 50 436. If you're calling from New Zealand or elsewhere, don't forget it's +61 and then area code 2 800 50 436. Well, as I mentioned in the intro there, we're preparing for a trip to the South Pacific, Fiji to be more precise. This is our second trip over there, and in fact we're heading off tomorrow as I'm recording this, so it's one of the last things I'm trying to get done before we head off. Last time we headed over there, I think we completed one webcam cache, and we tried to set up a WWFM event, and we gave a bit of advance notice so that hopefully if there were any people from Australia or around the world who happened to be in the area at the time, fortunately no one else was there. So we've got one event which was attended by ourselves and one webcam cache. But since we've been there, there's been quite a few new caches that have appeared in Fiji, and just so happens that one of the islands we're staying at has one as well. I won't give you too much away about it, but it's an interesting cache. We'll reveal it in the next episode. Now, hopefully, if you haven't already, you're a regular subscriber to It's Not About the Numbers blog, which is quite an interesting blog about geocaching around the world. It's actually put together by a duo from New Zealand and well put together. If you want to find out more about it, you can head to their website, which is It's Not About the Number, or Not About the Numbers, sorry, don't leave the it's off the end. So Not About the Numbers, one word, .com. And one of the entries that I saw pop up in the last few days was that the word geocaching had been added to the dictionary. Now, it's been added to the Merriam-Webster's dictionary, which is one of the dictionaries commonly used in the US. I thought, surely it's been in the dictionary for longer than that. And sure enough, when I did a bit of a search, I went back into the dictionary we use here in Australia, the Macquarie Dictionary, and I noticed that it actually was added in its fourth edition back in 2005. So a big pat on the back to us Australians for beating the Americans to it and getting geocaching into the dictionary. Interested to know if it's appeared in any other dictionaries around the world. I'll have to check if it's in the Oxford Concise Dictionary. Must check that one out. Now, I'm not going to blab too much because I've still got a little bit of packing to do, but fortunately we had a few calls come in, and we'll start off first of all from across the ditch from over in New Zealand, one of our contributors, the organist, also known as Martin.
G'day, Darren, the organist here. I'm situated just outside a little town called Rakaia, which is about half an hour south of Christchurch, on the road to Dunedin, incidentally. And I'm just about to start my very first ever power trail. It's a long road called Thompson's Track, and it's got about 80 caches. I'm being very, very careful to make sure my 2000th find is not involved in this power trail, so it won't be. And might check in later in the day. Cheers.
G'day, GeoTalk. It's Darth Trader calling in, walking along a little bush track around Newcastle with Affinitas. It's about 9 o'clock at night. It's a bit cool. And we're going for an SPS. There's a 5-5. Yes, I know we're crazy. It's a 5-5 and it's 9 o'clock at night. It's mental, but we should be committed because of this geocaching. So this particular cache, Enigmatic, was listed by Marcus Vitruvius back in April. And I've been working away, trying to solve it on and off, and been asking questions and trying to sort out all the red herrings out of the listing, and we finally come up with a green light on the geo cobalt checker tonight, and we couldn't wait till tomorrow to come and have a crack. So we're going for this walk on a cool Saturday night, and we'll call you back and let you know how we go later on.
Well, thank you, Darth Trader, for that. We'll catch up with you a little bit later, along with the organist. We'll see how those two guys are going in their caching adventures. Well, it's time now to head across the ditch over to New Zealand and catch up with Alan, Radio Nut 50.
Yeah, hi there to all cachers from Radio Nut 50 in Hamilton, New Zealand, with some thoughts from the east side of the Tasman Sea today. Some may remember a couple of podcasts ago I mentioned that Butterfly Lady and I have a pair of racing travel bugs. Well, a couple of years ago, we released two matching travel bugs in a cache in Daylesford, Victoria, when we're on our trip to the famous first Australian mega event in Wagga Wagga. They were two zebras. Linda's is called Zara and mine called Zeke. They were released together with a mission to race each other back to one of our caches here in Hamilton City, New Zealand. Well, that time, Zara came home reasonably quickly, but Zeke got it all wrong and headed for Perth. Then finally got back to New South Wales and somewhere managed to get lost. Okay, so June this year we were in Tasmania, so Zeke was reincarnated before we left. It's amazing how a toy shop and a tag copier can help that. Then the pair was released again, this time in Hobart for another race back to Hamilton. And history repeated itself. Zara made some moves and was picked up by a cacher called Biggles 58, who took her for a fantastic trip around much of the east coast of Australia, calling in at no less than 289 caches on her way. Then she got dropped off in the prescribed cache in Hamilton Gardens and is back home again. Zeke, on the other hand, did a bit of a lap of Tasmania, stopped in a TB hotel and was picked up by a cacher, but hasn't been dropped since. Ah, well, maybe next time, old friend. It'd be good to have him back sometime soon, though, to get into some training. This is a really fun way to enjoy caching as a couple, and I'd recommend it. Last weekend, we took a whole weekend participating in a couple of caching skills events. One was in Auckland on Saturday, and one in Hamilton on Sunday. These came from an idea by Tracy, who caches under the name of Team Welsh, and run by a team of experienced cacher volunteers. The day was made up of multiple streams of presentations on caching topics, and I think they went really well, with good attendance and lots of happy logs afterwards. I'd recommend attending or organising an event like this if you had the chance. They're lots of fun and really good for sharing of ideas. I've continued to experiment with a range of Android caching applications, and currently am enjoying one called CacheSense. So far, this one seems to be the most flexible and the quickest one at getting caches up on the screen, from my experience. I'd certainly recommend you give it a try if you're wanting to use your phone while out caching, but I would warn again against using the GPS capabilities of any smartphone to actually find a cache. Unless you like searching larger areas of ground for the hide, especially if you're under a tree or anything. But they're really useful for a quick lookup and looking up logs or photos on cache pages or very current, recent logs. So while on this topic though, I'm on the hunt for any smartphone caching application that you can load local maps onto your phone with, preferably the Garmin open source maps or something similar that I've already got. It'd be great to be able to do some checking on a phone when actually out of cell phone coverage. I've seen some mention that they have the ability to load maps, but they always seem to be for some special format available in Europe or North America, nothing that works around here. Google Maps application itself can now preload some areas, but I've found that having done that on my phone, they still don't seem to be available for other applications that use Google Maps on it. Anyhow, I've got a pretty low opinion of the accuracy of Google Maps for finding stuff closer than 20 metres accuracy. So if anyone's got a suggestion, feel free to contribute it as a note to Darren for future podcasts. There's a new series of caches in New Zealand. A US cacher by the name of Robert, who operates under the caching name of 8 Man After, was assisted by well-known New Zealand cacher Gavin the Red Iguana, and they've organised 19 individual cachers around the country to each set up caching across New Zealand, CANZ or CANS. These caches occupy the 16 official regions of our country, and the series will take you to a variety of special places. Each cache then has inside it a number, which leads you to a decoded waypoint for the North Island and another for the South Island intermediate caches. Then finding them will lead you to the grand final. To get to the final, you therefore have to have toured much of New Zealand and seen some pretty special locations. The series is modelled on a similar one in the US, and Linda and I have enjoyed participating as owners of the Waikato Regional Cache. So if you're caching in our country as a visitor, or perhaps a local wanting to get a great tour of the scenery, do a search for caches with the name starting with C-A-N-Z. Each one has inside the page a set of links to all the others. They've been released for about a month now, and I see there's a fair few number of finds on all of them, but no one's got the North Island or the South Island intermediates yet. So no one's anywhere near getting the final. I wonder who's going to get the first to find on that one. Okay, to a quick roundup of events in New Zealand listed. In the North Island, there's just one, and it's story time, and it's part of the International Geocaching Day celebration in Whanganui, but listed on the 30th of August. In the South Island, there's one called Spring is Sprung, and it's listed in Christchurch on the 8th of September. There's a Cromwell Spring Cleanup Seaito on the 6th of October, and of course there's that great first New Zealand mega event, and it's open for registrations and listed for the 20th of October. That's getting closer all every day. Okay, that's all. Back to you, Darren.
Well, thanks for that, Alan. Going back to your point about being able to load in maps, I have a feeling that Neon Geo can do it. I've actually gone back to it. I was using CacheSense for a while, but for some reason I seem to find that it was very slow at getting caches, in particular downloading Pocket Queries. It seemed to hang downloading Pocket Queries. May have been my connection with my data provider. May have been the phone. I'm not too sure. But I've gone back to Neon Geo, which I'm quite happy with, and I've actually already loaded the GPX files for Fiji into it so that I don't have to use a data link, because there's no way I'm switching the data on when I'm overseas. But if anyone else has got any tips on how you can preload maps, in particular OpenStreetMap, then by all means, give us a bell, geotoolpodcast@gmail.com or 02 800 50 436. Now, regular long-time listeners of the podcast will realise that over the last couple of episodes, we've been missing a section. It's the trivia quiz. So I thought, why not get it back in again? So here's the GeoTalk trivia question for this episode. And given that we're about to head off into the South Pacific, I thought I'd ask, how many caches are there in the Pacific, not just the South Pacific, but also in the North, with the exclusion of Australia, New Zealand and Hawaii? So how many caches are there in the Pacific, and which country has the most? The answer to that at the end of the podcast. Well, on this episode of GeoTalk, we're going to head off the geocaching trail a little bit and look at one of the things that a lot of geocachers use, and I know we've discussed a bit on the podcast, and that's OpenStreetMap. And joining me on the podcast is one of the Australian coordinators of OpenStreetMap, known as Nick, or to some of his geocaching pals, NM7S9. Welcome to the podcast, Nick.
Thank you.
So, first of all, tell us about, quickly, your role in OpenStreetMap.
Oh, my role's just like anyone else, just a mapper. I was doing the geocaching, and one of the geocachers told me about OpenStreetMap, and so I had a look, and I found that my street hadn't been mapped, so of course I mapped it, and then I had to map a few around it, and then the neighbourhood, and then the city, and then as much as I could of the state. So it's, it just took off from there. It's fairly addictive. So yeah, I'm just a mapper. I don't have any other role in OpenStreetMap.
Right. Well, tell us a little bit briefly about OpenStreetMap. When did it start, and how has it grown over the years?
Well, I started in about 2007, I think, about 5 years ago. And at that stage, the map of Australia was pretty much just the major highways. I think it started off in England. Steve Coast started it off. And I think that was probably about 2005, something like that. So about 6 or 7 years ago. And about 2007, then it just went exponential from there. People got interested, and the mapping in America, England, Australia took off fairly quickly. and it sort of spread to other countries in the world after that.
Okay, and I suppose in a way it's kind of like a Wikipedia, but a map version of Wikipedia where anyone can contribute and change things and so forth. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. And then there's peer review. People have a look and say, oh, yeah, that's right, or that's a bit wrong, or you could be doing it this way, and they'll help fix it out. So yeah, very much like Wikipedia. It's crowdsourced and community peer pressure to obey certain standards, I guess, even though you can do whatever you like. But everyone tries to do it in a similar fashion so that it's usable by software all over the world.
Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, it's become quite popular, and I'll go into a little bit about the licensing and so forth, but pretty much anyone can use the data that's from it and construct maps out of that. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. And for a couple of years now, there have been people have dragged the data out of OSM and turned it into maps that can be used on your navigation units. So fully routable map. So, yeah, for a couple of years now, you can actually navigate all around Australia and most countries in the world using the OpenStreetMap data.
Mm-hmm. Now, how can geocaches contribute? I mean, you mentioned yourself that you were a geocache, and obviously you've discovered an area down in Canberra that was missing some data. What can geocaches do to add to OpenStreetMap?
Well, there's two answers to this. One is, what can they do in general? And the other is, what can they do sort of right now, which is to do with what you're going to talk about with the license change and the data redaction. So the geocaches could really help out now. But in general, I guess if you're visiting a cache, take your GPS with you and collect some maps and note things along the way, walking trails, restrictions like fences, any points of interest along the way, maybe a coffee shop that you stop somewhere to have coffee, and then when you get home, have a look on OpenStreetMap, and if there's stuff that you've collected that's not in the map, just get onto OpenStreetMap, and you can edit it on the spot.
Now, some people are worried that they make a mistake. I mean, what happens if for example, you accidentally delete a street, or you add something in that you didn't mean to add in? I mean, does it get picked up by other editors?
Usually, some things might go a few weeks or something, I guess. But people are looking at it quite often, so they'll pick up if there's something wrong, and then they'll send you a nice polite email saying, "Did you mean to do that?" And here's how you can fix it, or they might even fix it for you or help you fix it. It's a pretty good community that way. Everyone helps out.
Originally, OpenStreetMap was Creative Commons Share Alike, but that has recently changed to a new licensing agreement. Can you briefly explain what is the new license and why was it changed from Creative Commons? And then what was the flow-on effect, why some people didn't agree with it?
Okay, well, actually, you're talking to the wrong person now, because I'm of the opinion that I'd like it all to just be public domain. I'd like everyone to be able to use their data for whatever purpose they like, free of any encumbrance. So I don't actually care about the license. But the people who do, the lawyers seem to tell them that the CC by SA license wasn't appropriate for a database. So this is a whole new area of copyright law, which I don't understand, probably because I'm not interested in it. And the lawyers are telling them that, yes, the ODBL license was appropriate, but the CC by SA at the moment isn't. And so the project decided to move to the ODBL license, and some people don't agree with that and have decided to leave the project because of it. Mm-hmm. So it's a very difficult question, and I understand nothing about it because I really don't care about it. All I care is that it's up to date and accurate.
Because I mean, if you find this one too difficult to answer, let me know. There's been some in the geocaching community who had been using OpenStreetMap until recently, who believe that the change might have had something to do with commercial groups such as MapQuest that were using OpenStreetMap data. That there was a need to change it so that they could either sell the data or unsell it, or there'd be some commercial agreement. Do you know if that's the case?
No, but I think the push for the license change came well before the state of the map, if you like, got to a point where it was commercially usable. Mm-hmm. So the license change debate's been going on for many years now, at least 3 years, I think, well before we had people like MapQuest using the data and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So it was happening anyway, and I don't believe it was to do with any particular organisation, no. Mm-hmm.
All right, so as a result, I mean, a number of people decided that they didn't want to agree to have the new their data under the new licensing agreement. And then last month, I suppose there was an automatic process where their data was removed from the map. What effect has that had to the map here in Australia and more broadly overseas?
Quite a significant effect, because unfortunately the data that they'd contributed, other people had then added to it. Like some of them had traced roads in, and then other people had actually gone out and collected the street names and edited them on the top of the road. But now, because their data had to be removed, the whole lot's gone. So a lot of other people's work had to get thrown out as well. So what's happening now is we're trying to rebuild that data, and people have to go out again and read the street signs and get the names and which are one-way roads and that sort of thing and edit them in. So in the meantime, there's a pre-redaction copy of the database still available for anyone who wants to use it in their car navigation units or their maps or what have you. But for a little while now, the actual database itself, yes, like especially Sydney and Adelaide are the two places where there are a lot of roads that have been traced back in that haven't got names. So that's where the geocaches, especially in Sydney and Adelaide, but all around Australia, could really help. Just reading street signs near where you live, have a check on OpenStreetMap, and if you find that they haven't been named yet, just edit them in. It only takes a minute or two.
Does OSM have any idea, or the people in charge have any idea how long it might take to get back to the state it was pre-redaction?
Well, it's happening a lot quicker than we thought. About a year or so, I thought it would take 2 years to get back to where we were, but it's going to be a lot quicker than that. In America, it's only going to be about 3 or 4 months, I think. Canberra's pretty much right now. Sydney, I think, is going to take 6 months. I'm just guessing, right? Mm-hmm. 6 months, 7 months. Adelaide will take about the same. So it's maybe by Christmas, mm-hmm. or maybe a bit after.
Mm-hmm. And personally, do you think it might have damaged the reputation of the map?
I don't think it's damaged the reputation of the map. It's damaged the community, the divisiveness between the people who left and the people who stayed. It's certainly damaged the community, and that damages the whole project, because that's all the project is a community. Mm-hmm. But there are signs now that community is starting to build back together, and it'll be as strong as it ever was in 6 or 7 months, at pretty much the same rate as the map gets repaired, as the community will be repaired as well. Yeah. And fortunately, because of this thing called the contributor terms, this can never happen again. From now on, if it's determined that the OpenStreetMap license has to change for whatever reason, then we can't lose any of the current data like has happened this time. No, okay. So this is an unfortunate one-off, but it's a real pain, and it's the best thing about it is it's just about over now.
Okay. All right, so the good news is that hopefully by the end of the year or maybe early next year, the map will be back to where it was, and the more people that get involved, the quicker that'll happen.
Yes, definitely, and certainly in Sydney and Adelaide, we really do need people getting around reading street signs, because that's the point about OpenStreetMap is that we don't just take second-hand information from other places. We go out and read the signs and look what's actually on the ground and put that in so that the maps are 100% accurate. Mm-hmm. And, so it's a bad time for the project at the moment, or has been for the last 6 months, but it's swinging back now and it's coming good again, but it's still going to take a few months.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, look, on behalf of all the listeners, thanks very much for taking the time out and telling us all about OpenStreetMap, and all the best in your OSM and geocaching adventures. Thanks very much, Nick.
Okay. No worries, Darren. Thank you.
Time. time now to have a look at some of the events occurring around Australia over the next few weeks. And on the 25th of August is the Ballarat versus Bendigo event. That's being held in Bendigo, obviously a group from Ballarat heading up to that one. On the 26th of August is the See You Later Sunny Coast. That's up in the Sunshine Coast in Queensland. And also on the 26th of August is the Urban Treasure Ramble. That's being held in Adelaide in South Australia. On the 1st of September, Monkeys in the Park up at Townsville in Queensland. On the 4th of September, the regular pub lunch being titled Hello Spring. That's being held in Adelaide in South Australia. And also in South Australia, in Adelaide, on the 13th of September is Witwat by the Chili Butts. It's an interesting cage name. That's being held on the 13th of September. On the 23rd of September is the NZ Mega 1 month to go farewell lunch. That's being held at Wallace, just near Ballarat in central Victoria. And on the 29th of September, two events, Having a Foul Time at Glue Pot, that's near Berry in South Australia, and the Mid-North Coast Campout in New South Wales. That's on the Mid-North Coast, sort of halfway between, I think, Taree and Port Macquarie, and that's being held on the 29th. Also, a big shout-out to the guys over in the Mid-North Coast. They've just set out a power trail, which I think goes from the Hunter Valley to the Mid-North Coast. There was about 200-odd or 200-plus geocaches. A pair, Big Matt and Shell and Marcus Vitruvius, from all accounts, got about 190 first to finds or possibly more. Crazy people, because apparently the weather was atrocious. But anyway, they're the events that are occurring around the country, around Australia, over the next few weeks. Don't forget, if you've got one that you want to give a shout out for, give us a call, drop us an email, and hopefully you'll be able to make it to one of those soon. It's time now to go back to those calls. Let's start off first of all with Martin over in New Zealand.
Well, the organist here again from New Zealand, and I'm probably about halfway along this power trail, and met up with Weka, Keisha from Dunedin. And so we're doing it together. We just stopped for a bit of a bite to eat and a bit of a natter about caches and power trails in the UK. And of course, I had the park lights on at the time. And now they've gone off, and my car won't start. Now, there's a hint for power trails. If you're doing it by car, it might even pay to keep your engine running. Either that or get a really good battery before you start. So I'm just waiting for them to notice that I've disappeared from the radar, and hoping that they might be kind enough to come back and help me jumpstart this car. All right. Hopefully I'll be able to get your next episode. If no one hears from me, I'm stuck on the corner of Thompson's Track and Ural Road. If anyone wants to come and give me a push.
G'day, GeoTalk. It's just Darth Trader. We've got a bit of the shakes at the moment. I've just descended the tree. How high do you reckon that was, Affinitive? Yeah, it'd be about that, 10 to 15 for sure. So I've got about 50 metres of rope strapped over my shoulder, and we've been up the tree. We found a case, we opened the logbook, and we were the first name in there. So this has been listed for 3 months, enigmatic, and we're FTF on it, on a 5.5, and it's now almost 11 o'clock at night. So, it took a bit of effort, and I'm glad we had bought the rope with us, because we certainly needed it. But, fantastic case, layer upon layer upon layer of mystery to solve. You give the mental brain an exercise. Before he even got here. But well done, Marcus Vitruvius, and certainly a challenge for anyone else attempting it. That's enigmatic in the Newcastle area. KGOTalk, over and out.
Well, well done, Darth, in cracking that one. I know Marcus Vitruvius, who we mentioned a bit earlier, he certainly sets a high standard for someone who's found 8,000-plus geocaches in such a short time. Well done in achieving that, getting that geocache. Also in the mailbag, I got an email that came in from Paul by the name of goes by the name of Griffo, and he writes, "Darren, I've recently returned from a trip to the US and went a long way to completing the Yasma or Jasma, depending on how you pronounce it, challenge, and that involves finding a cache in each month since geocaching began in May 2000. I only have five to go, and I'm trying to find the last five which seems to be a bit of an elusive task. He says, I've tried doing a query through Geocaching Australia, GCA, looking for the five I need, ticking what I think are all the correct boxes, but I'm unable to find the caches required to complete the challenge. In fact, I'm unable to find the cache that I found in that was placed in May 2000, which is GC12 and GC17 in Oregon. The query doesn't show up any caches worldwide placed in August or September. He's wondering, basically, how can you go about using the GCA pocket query to try and find this? Now, Paul, it's an interesting question because it highlights two things, first of all, or two shortcomings in both the GCA and the GC websites if you're trying to complete this YASMA challenge. The first thing is that with GCA, they only contain caches that have been found by caches who are registered on GCA and that have been and that cache has been found on a regular basis. So, for example, pretty much all the caches that are in Australia will a shortcut or a link will appear in the GCA listings and you'll be able to find them, and you can also show them up in pocket queries. Of course, they don't include the coordinates to that particular cache. You would have to go back to gc.com. But overseas caches, they will appear on GCA if, for example, you did a My Finds pocket query, and you've done caching overseas. So those caches will then appear on the listing. But in an interesting quirk, what actually happens is I think it's either 12 months or 24 months. If no one has found, no GCA registered caches have found that particular cache, then that cache appears as archived on the GCA listing. It's a bit of sure there's a reason behind it. I'll have to ask Peter one day about the reason why. So using GCA isn't an ideal tool for doing this. Now, I notice you're a premium member, and all premium members, what they can do is set up a pocket query on gc.com to be able to work out which caches are near them or which caches are around the place that have been placed in a particular month or date range. So the best thing to do is just to go to your pocket query page, start a new pocket query and select caches I haven't found, and then choose a date range from, say, the 1st of the month to the 31st or 30th or 28th, 9th in the case of February. Then you have to choose a location, and you usually have to choose it by country. Now, in the case of Australia, I know for certain that the three or four that I'm missing aren't in Australia, so they're not actually going to show up, and you need to sort of hunt around the place. So you may need to change it to the United States or to Belgium or France or to the UK, Canada, that sort of thing, and that can be a time-consuming process. The best thing I think you should do is if particular the caches you're looking for in the year 2000 or 2001, is have a look through the bookmarks that have been set up on gc.com. Now, there's one in particular, and I'll give you a link to this in the show notes. It's been set up by I Am Orack, so that's IAMORACKE, and he set up one called Inaugural Year 2000 Caches, and you can actually scan through that list. I think there's about 120 or 200 of them that you can go through, and you can work out which particular caches you're missing. As I've mentioned, I'm going to have to go, I think, to North America or possibly to North Europe to complete mine. But one day I'll hopefully do it. So anyway, that's another challenge for people out there. If you've already done your well-rounded cacher and you've already done your calendar caching challenge, well, the YASMA or JASMA challenge is another one to try. Incidentally, I haven't been able to find out why it's called that name. If anyone knows, drop us a line. Love to find out. Well, time to wrap up with the mailbag. Let's go back to Martin just to see how he went with that power trail over in New Zealand.
All right, the organist here from New Zealand again, and just reaching the last cache in the series, cache number 40.
And that, in the whole world.
It's not quite the last cache in the whole world, but it's certainly the last cache that we're going to do today. So just one DNF on the power trail itself. The clue for this one is on a zebra sign and it's magnetic. So little Hannah, who's four, baby organist. Now, we've got to find the geocache. Where do you think it's going to be?
Yeah.
What's the clue, Grant? Base of post zebra sign. Grant, by the way, we came across him on the way. Jennifer and Grant are Weka from Dunedin. So base of post zebra sign. Okay, well, that's great. 22 metres away, he says. Rightio.
This isn't where we should all to be. All right. Hannah, we're at the wrong place.
All right, go on. Let's go and we'll walk another 20 metres.
Yeah.
Oh, look, there's another zebra sign. Zebra sign. Why is this a zebra, Hannah? Why do you think this might be called a zebra sign?
Over here. Oh, look.
What's at the bottom of the post?
Can you see something down the bottom of the post?
You see. I'll have a look at the other
side. Is he okay?
No. You sure?
What have you found? Wow. Is there any treasure inside?
Yeah.
Bit hard to open that one,
isn't
it? Oh, let's have a look inside. Oh, it's full of water. Full of water. There's been floods here recently, so. Any treasure? You have a look in there.
Treasure!
Yay! All right. Well, our treasure is signing the logbook and heading back home. So, all the best and thanks for the podcast. And look forward to seeing you here for the mega.
Please open this because it's a
and watch your head when you stand up.
Well, thanks for that, Martin, and well done. Well, it's time now to wrap up the podcast. Before we go, better give you the answer to the trivia question, and that was, how many geocaches are there in the Pacific, excluding Australia, New Zealand, and Hawaii? And the total number is 782, which is not a bad number, but here's the interesting thing when you break it down. The countries that don't have caches, or the regions, territories, whatever you want to call them, with zero are Pitcairn Islands, Tuvalu or Tuvalu, and Solomon Islands. I'm actually quite surprised on that last one. Nauru has one, Kiribati has three, Niue has four geocaches along with Tonga. American Samoa and Samoa, or Western Samoa, both have five each. The Marshall Islands and Norfolk Island have six. Papua New Guinea has seven. The Cook Islands have eight, along with French Polynesia. Vanuatu has nine. Micronesia, 10. New Caledonia, 11. The North Marianas Islands, 12. Palau, or Palau, I'm not sure how you pronounce that, I'll have to work that one out, has 15. Coming in second, where I'm heading off to, Fiji, with 29. And the Pacific Island nation with the most number of caches is Guam, with 639 geocaches. That's 81% of the Pacific. And given that it's a US territory and geocaching is a US-invented game, I'm not surprised there's so many there. Anyway, that's the answer, and that's the podcast for this particular episode. As I said, we're heading off to Fiji within less than 24 hours. Hopefully we'll get some audio. If not, we'll bring back some stories. But in the meantime, I'm interested in any stories you have from the South Pacific or from the Pacific, any geocaches that you've found that have been outstanding. Give us a call on the GeoTalk hotline, 02-800-5436. Record it, drop it in an email, geotalkpodcast@gmail.com, or just type it up and send us an email. And if you send one in and we read it out, we'll send you a little prize in the mail. So we're looking for your best Pacific geocaching stories. Until next time, safe geocaching.